We hear a lot about the trouble Europe is in. The debt crisis in Greece and Ireland, perhaps Spain and Portugal, is threatening the whole continent. But while the bad news of the euro crisis makes headlines in the U.S., what does not make headlines is the good news of a quiet revolution that has taken place in Europe. The European Union, 27 member nations with a half billion people, has become the largest, wealthiest trading bloc in the world, producing nearly a third of the world's economy, nearly as large as the U.S. and China combined. Europe has more Fortune 500 companies than either the U.S., China, or Japan. European nations are rated by the World Health Organization as having the best healthcare systems in the world, yet they spend far less than the U.S. for universal coverage, even as U.S. healthcare ranks 37th. Europe leads in confronting global climate change with renewable energy technologies like solar and wind power, conservation, green design, creating hundreds of thousands of new jobs in the process. Europe is twice as energy efficient as the U.S., and their ecological footprint, the amount of the Earth's capacity that a population consumes, is about half that of the United States for the same standard of living. Now, let me make it personal. We all know that unemployment is widespread and perhaps becoming chronic in the United States. But did you know that when Americans have jobs, we work much longer hours than our peers in Europe? Before the recession, American workers were working 1,800 hours per year versus 1,436 hours for Germans. That's the equivalent of 9 extra 40-hour work weeks per year. In his new book, Were You Born on the Wrong Continent?, today's guest, Tom Gagan, makes a strong case that European social democracies, particularly Germany, have some lessons and some models that might make life a lot more livable. Not only that, they could help us keep our jobs. In comparison to the U.S., the Germans have, as I said, 6 weeks of federally mandated vacation, free university tuition, nursing care, child care. But you've heard the arguments for years about how those wussy Europeans can't compete in a global economy. You've heard that so many times you might even believe it. But like so many things that the media repeats endlessly, it's just not true. According to Gagan, now I'm quoting, since 2003, it's not China, but Germany, that colossus of European socialism that has either led the world in export sales or at least been tied for first. Even as we in the United States fall far more deeply into the clutches of our foreign creditors, China foremost among them, Germany has somehow managed to create a high-wage, unionized economy without shipping all its jobs abroad or creating a massive trade deficit or any trade deficit at all. And even as the Germans outsell the United States, they still, as I said, manage to take 6 weeks of vacation every year. So they're beating us with one hand tied behind their back. Thomas Gagan, a graduate of Harvard and Harvard Law School, is a labor lawyer with Dupre, Schwartz, and Gagan in Chicago. He's been a staff writer and a contributing writer to the New Republic, and his work has appeared in many other journals. Gagan ran unsuccessfully in the Democratic primary to succeed Rahm Emanuel in Congress. And he's the author of 6 books, including Whose Side Are You On?, The Secret Lies of Citizens, and most recently, Were You Born on the Wrong Continent? And just this week, once I scheduled this interview, he came out with an article, 10 things the Democrats could do, 10 things the Dems could do right now to win. And so we're going to talk about that as well. And as Tom says, they're related. In other words, some of the things that you see in those models overseas, if the Dems had the nerve to do them over here, would probably wake things up and change things a lot. Here, let me say, welcome, Tom Gagan.
Terrence, thank you for inviting me.
Okay. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. And you start your book, Were You Born on the Wrong Continent, with a personal experience, a stopover in Zurich. Could you talk about that?
Oh, yes. Well, how did I discover Western Europe? You know, as an American, I'm here all the time working, 2,000 hours a year or whatever it is that the people in the more extreme jobs work. And in 1993, I got it in my head, for reasons and part of a story that is too long to tell, to go see a woman I had met who happened to be in Moscow. And because there was a coup that was going on in October 1993, all the flights to Moscow were canceled, and I ended up in Zurich. And while I was waiting for clearance to go to Moscow for this so-called vacation, I happened to walk around the streets, and I had not been in Western Europe for years, and I was just thunderstruck about how nice it was. It seemed like everything was, every bookstore was like a boutique, and there was, even in the train stations, was like a perfumery, and I thought, how did this part of the world, without my knowing it as an American, get so wealthy? And that was the epiphany that led me to take a bigger and bigger interest in how the Europeans live and to ask, ultimately, were you born on the wrong continent?
Yeah, and as you say, one of the things that struck me about that walk you take is that it seems you point out that if you have a safety net and if you don't have much poverty, then it's better for everybody. It's not just better for the poor, it's better for everybody. And the feeling in a city like Zurich, and then you go on to say, you know, many, many other cities in Europe. It's just, I think what struck you so much about Zurich is it's not a city that we talk about. It's not a city that people say, oh, you must visit Zurich.
Well, less poverty means less disorder. Less disorder means nicer spaces to walk around. You have more of the city available to you. Chicago's fantastic. Part of it. But there's a huge swath of it that you just not particularly want to go through, not because of its any criminal danger, but just because it is run down, shabby, the kind of bungalow neighborhoods on the northwest side where I was running for Congress, where it's largely still white ethnic. It's just very unattractive, dilapidated kind of place. And there are huge parts of the city that are just downright dangerous. Well, Europe isn't like that. It's the argument for social democracy, relatively more equality and less poverty and disorder.
Right. Some guests I had on the show a few months ago, Richard Wilkinson, I think it is, and Kate Pickett, who wrote The Spirit Level. I assume that you're familiar with that, which talks about how the countries with the most unequal distribution of wealth, everything is worse on average, and everything is worse for everybody, not just the poor, again, but the wealthy, the upper middle class, etc.
Sure. That was one of the arguments that is at the heart of this book, Were You Born on the Wrong Continent? It's clear to me, as a union-side labor lawyer, representing sometimes people who are janitors, truck drivers, who aren't in the so-called upper middle class, university-educated elite, that they're better off in a social democracy. They're just better off. There's union representation, there's wage bargaining, and all sorts of things that have disappeared here. So I wanted to make the argument that even people who are relatively at the top, I'm not talking about the super rich, but who pride themselves as doing a little bit better than other Americans, would be better off in a more egalitarian social democracy, literally, materially better off in an egalitarian social democracy that nominally has a lower GDP per capita, and why they would be better off, why the public goods that are available there for free, university education, in some ways are kind of skewed towards the benefit of the people who are relatively at the top.
That's right. That's right. As you say, at one point you say that it costs $50,000 a year for a private university. And my guess is that all things, you know, going into it, that as the tuition rises in some of the public universities, is a big number there as well, that someone who doesn't go to university in a European city doesn't get that benefit, but the family who sends two or three kids to university gets this enormous benefit. So that actually, this stuff drives me crazy, sort of, that in the U.S., the point is made that such reforms only help them, and them is always the poor, and the folks that, even if you're them now, you won't be long because of all this mobility we have here, which, of course, we don't have anymore. But as you point out, it's actually the benefits accrue even more to the middle class and the upper middle class.
I think so. Although, of course, in a certain way, the low-income sectors of these countries do better, too. Nonetheless, it could be said, well, look, there's poverty in Germany and so on and so forth. And there is. There's a growing amount of it. There has been some, especially during the 1990s and the early part of the last decade, a kind of scaling back of social democracy, but they still have vastly more than we do, and they scaled it back. This is one thing I was trying to get at and wasn't quite able to articulate as well as I would like if I went back into the book now, but I think I was on to it, and it's in the book. The fact that we have this casino-type capitalism here in the United States and in the UK, that it was so bloated or skewed towards the financial sector, led for a while to an allocation of capital into the U.S., the U.K., looking for hot returns, relatively starving, the virtuous countries of the world, which were based in manufacturing, like Germany. There are studies that are out now about this that confirm sort of this intuition I had in writing this book, and I'm really happy that those studies have come out. I wish I could have cited them in the book. What has happened since the collapse of this casino-type capitalism in 2008 is that the money has shifted back to where it should have been in the first place, more in these virtuous economies
and
are based on production of
capital. As I was going to say, productive economies.
Yeah.
That just as the U.S. skewed, I remember the first person I interviewed talking about that was Kevin Phillips in Bad Money, talking about how we had just year after year after year shifted more and more of our money, more and more of our best and brightest young people and so on, and more of we became dominated by finance. And what you're saying is that at a point when the casino seemed to be paying off, other countries shifted in our direction. But when it broke, we don't have the kind of manufacturing and export base that a country like Germany has to fall back on. When the crisis hit, spurred on by our casino, but it hit the whole world, we didn't have something to fall back on. Countries like Germany did.
Yes, and the Germans had a certain amount of schadenfreude about the whole thing, and they actually became a little more upbeat. They're basically very pessimistic people by temperament. Here was one world debacle that they weren't responsible for. And in fact, they did very well during the recession in that they had what they call a good recession, in that the German government was very quick off the mark. It was a Christian Democratic Union and SPD coalition at that time. That's the Socialist Party and the Christian Democratic Party. And they put in place immediately this what they call the short Kurzarbeit, the short work week program, which paid people to stay on the job so that people weren't who were underemployed, who were, might have been working 2 days a week and actually eliminated in return for other employees working harder and longer, those people were paid to stay on the job by the government so that, as one German labor minister said, we got ahead of the curve. The unemployment didn't drop here the way it did in the U.S. And when the economy recovered, there wasn't this incentive to hold off hiring again because the people were already on the job. So Their unemployment is now significantly lower than ours, and they have really had this huge spurt of economic growth recently, and the economy is booming, partly because I think this whole skewing of capital has now changed in the opposite direction.
Right. I remember when I was thinking about how, I mean, the problem we're dealing with now, which is the unemployment and the long-term unemployment and then consumer fear, which leads to less spending, which leads to longer-term unemployment, how sensible that policy was to, instead of letting people go, you just hold them back, and the government made up the difference.
Sure.
And I found this quote when Larry Summers, one of Obama's closest economic advisors, was asked why the president didn't pursue short-time work to stem the economic bleeding. He dismissed the idea, saying the White House wanted to create new jobs, not preserve old ones, which is, I mean, you know,
pretty lame answer.
Well, and the arrogance of it, you know, good for you, Larry. You know, what about the person who lost their job? And the family and the kids and all of that.
Well, Larry Summers is the villain of the book. I mean, he was kind of doing a war dance back in the late 1990s about how the U.S. model was triumphant overall, and he was an architect of this deregulation. Now, the shoe's on the other foot.
Yeah, let me just ask one thing about what is the status? We've talked about Germany recovering. What's the status, in your view, of the crisis in Europe right now? You know, in other words, there's a union that's linked together, but there's, as you say, virtuous economies like Germany, productive virtuous economies, and there seems to have been, you know, folks that were not nearly so.
Yes. Well, less virtuous economies were the so-called New Europe, with the inclusion of the UK, that Donald Rumsfeld was touting. You know,
right.
To the extent that you found people willing to go in Iraq, it was in the countries that are in trouble now economically. There is a connection. These were countries that were much more inclined to go the American model route, going into debt, heavily speculation in housing and using housing as the motor engine of the economy, really housing speculation, and big time opening of their economies to global bank debt financing. So Goldman Sachs poured tons of money into Greece, and other New York and London, and I should say German banks, which are also just as global and just as competitive, are pouring money into Spain.
Well, I know
all sorts of bubbles, none of which occurred in Germany and in the, quote, old Europe that Donald Rumsfeld wrote off.
Right.
So the bubbles collapsed there just when the bubbles collapsed here. They all went down together. That part of Europe is a part of Europe that is in trouble to the extent, and only to the extent, that it's involved in the American model.
And what about what I'm asking a little bit is the subtlety.
Countries that are most resistant to the American model are the countries in Europe that are doing fine.
Of course.
And by the way, why is it that Goldman Sachs was lending money to such weak economies like Greece? I mean, there's nothing there. There's no economy there. Why were they lending all that money? Because Greece was in the European Union, because Spain was in the European Union. These countries would never have gotten all this money from U.S. banks. And what is so important about the European Union? What is so important is that at the end of the day, the Germans are there, with their trade surplus, able to pay the money. And in fact, that's what has happened.
And that's what I'm asking also is, how is that relationship unfolding? The relationship of Germany, who, if it were not part of the European Union and did not feel the obligation to prop up those other economies, would be in one position. But here it is doing that. How is that working out? That's what I'm asking.
It's working out pretty well. The Germans are doing even better because everyone despaired, well, the euro will collapse and so forth. And the euro did drop. The euro was overvalued to begin with. Well, that made German goods more competitive. I should say, by the way, that for a long time, the dollar has depreciated not against the Chinese currency, but only against the euro. So, America keeps getting this edge over Europe that it's never, and Germany in particular, that it's never been able to exploit because we're not competitive enough. But after the Greek debt crisis, it went the other way. So, the euro became relatively cheaper. It didn't drop dramatically, and in fact, it keeps fluctuating a little bit vis-a-vis the dollar. But so that made Germany actually more profitable,
right? As an export country.
And
sure.
The other flip side of this is that Greece didn't collapse, and partly because the Germans bailed it out, and partly because, as it turns out, there was belt tightening in Greece, and there were plenty of tourists who were still coming in to make up that foreign exchange. They ended up not being such a debtor country.
Right. Yeah. One of the things I remember noticing when there was all the press about Greece and how it was going to drag down Europe and what was Europe going to do and what was Germany going to do was that Greece represents 2% of the European Union's total, I guess, GDP, whereas California represents 14% of the U.S., and yet when California reached out to the federal government for similar help, it did not get it. And you just, I think that's another thing Americans probably would have a hard time hearing.
It was overblown. But it's a whole state, so it creates a kind of, Greece, I'm not talking about California.
Yeah, right. I'm just
so
saying.
It creates a kind of story.
Yeah,
exactly. But it's turned out to be fine. I have to say, I felt when the Greek debt crisis was coming out, I say in this book that you will see in the New York Times every 6 weeks some story about how Europe is going to collapse, and I've been seeing them ever since I graduated from college in 1971. I mean, they just come out like clockwork. And an early reader of this book emailed and said, now, I know you say that the New York Times is always saying that Europe is about to collapse, and of course, right now, the New York Times is writing stories saying Europe is about to collapse, but could they be right this time? And I wrote back, no. And my editor, to whom I, in a moment of insecurity, said, well, maybe I should write something about this Greek debt crisis and put it in the book. And she said, although no economist, she said, don't. Why? Because by the time this book comes out at the end of August, people will have forgotten about the Greek debt crisis. It's all over the news right now, Sarah. How can you say that? So recently I called her up and said, Sarah, I know that you're just a literary English major from blah, 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 but you should be heading the President's Council of Economic Advisors.
Yeah, I had it. I did pull.
She was right.
Yeah, I pulled
it's
one
gone.
Of those. one of those articles in New York Times in May, which is when the Greek crisis was hot, and Stephen Erlanger wrote, "Europeans fear crisis threatens liberal benefits," and he just goes into how finally this is going to, you know, changes have now become urgent. And what you point out is that when a country, for instance, since you focus this book on Germany, when Germany does make some changes that they might raise the age of retirement or something, they usually balance it with a benefit.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to give an example, just
there are all sorts of examples that you can give. They cut back something and then they add something else. They cut back on a holiday. But they add a nursing home benefit, you know. So, but the press story is always, oh, the Germans cut back something, and they do cut back things. But there are a lot of little variables and ways of adjusting the system. And I have to say, this one of the reasons I wrote this book was to show that there is a kind of leadership class over there that is very clever about manipulating these things and thoughtful about it. I don't mean in a spurious, tricky way, but actually thinking, well, you know, what do we have to cut back now so that we can go forward in the future? You know, or to quote this wonderful line from the Lampedusa novel, The Leopard, about the Sicilian aristocrat at the when the old order is collapsing, saying to his son, the young prince, well, we have to change so that everything remains the same. You know, how do you change the social democracy so that you've preserved it and create an opportunity, maybe even to expand it in a year or two when the wheel of fortune, you know, turns again and the economy is
right. Well,
prospering.
I mean, things do change. Markets change. Demographics change. It makes sense that if you are, as you say, intelligently marshaling all of this, you would adapt. But over here, you're right. The headline goes to the downside, wherever that is. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Thomas Gagan. He's a Chicago-based labor lawyer, the author of 6 books, and the latest one, the one we're talking about right now, is Were You Born on the Wrong Continent? And you can learn more at tomgagan.com, and that's G-E-O-G-H-A-G-E-N. Let's jump into some of the contrast in the book and what it is about our culture and theirs. People in the U.S. work more, I said, a lot more, 9 more weeks per year if you look at it in terms of hours. When you talked about yourself working 2,300 rather than the 1,800 I quoted as the average for American workers, what you're saying is that that's the average, but there's an awful lot of people that work more. And this 2,300, where did you get that number? Because it shows up a lot.
Oh, those are the extreme jobs. You know, they're different. Nobody has a good handle on these numbers. There are different estimates. You know, the ILO has a larger one. The OECD has a smaller one. So what's the explanation for that? I should say that all the estimates are the same in that they show big disparities between Europe and the United
States.
Exactly.
So why do we work so hard? Why do we work so hard?
Interview polling. Others are done by looking at what employers are reporting. Others are done by an amalgam of a mix of both. So you come out with different counts. I don't think there are some people working 2,300 hours a year in the U.S. When I was talking about that, I'm talking about the people who work in the so-called extreme jobs, of which the United States is notorious for having some. But you know, most people don't work that long. It's only the most driven. But the people who are a notch or two below the most driven are working longer than 1,800 hours a year.
Right.
And we don't count hours that are off the clock or that are fraudulent. We don't have agencies here the way the Europeans do, like unions, works councils, governments that tell people to go home, that have some real secure sense of so that we don't have the same secure sense of what the hours worked here really are.
Yeah, let me jump in.
I think they overcount their hours over there, given the fact that people take.
Right. Let me jump in for a second, because one of the things you say that's sort of interesting is, so why do we work so hard? One of the things you say is that because we don't have unions, because we don't have this social contract, people are afraid that if they don't work weekends, they don't work overtime, they don't skip their kids' soccer game, etc., that they'll get laid off.
I mean, you're in a situation where if nobody knows who's going to be laid off next, there's no order to it. It's all arbitrary. Chainsaw Al could knock down your cubicle door. So everyone has an incentive to stay 5 minutes longer in the cubicle than everyone else, and then, of course, that creates a situation where there's anarchy. You know, everybody's staying longer than everybody else, and everybody's staying longer and longer and longer. And that's the kind of situation that economists like Richard Freeman, you know, labor economist at Harvard, whose work is, I think, really the best work of labor economists in the U.S., what he and Linda Bell have argued in various pieces. I think it's similar to Juliet Shore's argument, but the Freeman-Bell work has been impressive to me in showing that that explains the big difference between U.S. and European hours.
Right.
There's nobody to tell you to go home. There aren't any works councils like in Germany, where we'll get into that.
Have
to reach agreements
right.
with the works councils
right.
about how long people stay. And by God, they're home.
Right. We'll get into those works councils in a second. So again, just looking at what the facts are, and then we'll unravel a little bit. Are we more productive given the fact that we work more?
Well, working doesn't increase productivity. In fact, it probably decreases it if you consider productivity as output per hour. I mean, obviously, if you're working 20 hours versus 8 hours in a concentrated way, you're going to be less productive. You know, as I told this story about my friend Isabel came to the United States, and she was at Northwestern and in a grad school program, and she was so distressed when she opened the course catalog, this was years ago, and found that there were no holidays here. And I found her in the middle of the year, you know, she's very bright, you know, she was just so stressed out, and I finally figured out what was happening. She was working with German efficiency at American hours, you know, and people would blow a fuse like that. It is, I think, clear, when you look at the German work hours and what they're able to produce, and there's placement at the top of the world in terms of export sales and dealing with countries like China where people work around the clock till they drop, that they must be doing something to make themselves more efficient. It's true, however, that the fact that Americans work longer and longer, longer hours increases what we count as GDP per capita, but it decreases the leisure time, which also has material value. It doesn't necessarily raise your standard of living, even if it pumps up your GDP per capita.
Right, and let's move to GDP. One of the things that I have contended for some time is that I find the fact that Americans don't know how things actually work in European countries. I have a feeling that for many people, what we're saying here, both in terms of just the facts of Germany being the number one export, or you know, in a give and take the rise and fall of the euro, number one with China and so on, and all of this is mind blowing. That even progressives, I find, in America, don't look overseas for the models that we're going to talk about in the second half about the work councils and the representation of labor on boards and so on, and it seems almost pathological how our exceptionalism infects even those who think they don't believe it.
Yes, I have a friend who has just come back from being a journalist for a long time in France, and she now works in the D.C. Washington D.C. media rat race, you know, political reporter. And she's in a carpool with other women who are also journalists who go into work. And she recently told me, it's become impossible for me to stay in this carpool because all I do all the time is say to these women who I drive into town with, oh, it's so much better in France, it's so much better in France. This is so much better. If this happened, we wouldn't. In France, it's so much better. She said, they are just so sick of me. They don't want to hear anything more about France. And there is a way in which if you say this, people just tune out here, and it's in some ways understandable. In some ways, it's tragic.
That's what I think it is.
And
yes.
A friend of mine, another journalist, says the three most deadly words in American journalism are "in Sweden they ... You know, people just don't keep going from there. And why is that? Because these are economies and developed at a level of sophistication that is like ours. They look like the U.S. They are like the U.S. in so many ways. You know, people say, well, you know, Europe's becoming just like America, and you're over there in Berlin. It could be in America in certain moments. You look around, oh, this could be the U.S. But it's not. It's just the opposite. That doesn't make it less interesting. It makes it more interesting. Why aren't we like this?
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I had Stephen Hill on a few months back, maybe that was in May, with his book Europe's Promise. And this is one of my soapboxes at this point is, you know, wake up, look over there. There are other models. Let's make a quick comparison of GDP. You referred to it a bit, but one of the things that you say, of course, and that I think a lot of people say, is GDP has only an addition side. It doesn't have a subtraction side. So, I mean, just for the sake of it, an auto accident increases GDP.
Crime increases GDP. Waste and fraud and gambling.
Katrina increases GDP. All sorts of things.
Urban sprawl, especially.
That's right.
GDP.
When you went into
lined
things,
up in the traffic increases GDP.
Exactly. That the half an hour that you're spending in traffic and the things that you're, and the fact also that we have monetized so many things. You point out the daycare costs for a family here that would be given to them by the government in so many European countries here add to GDP.
Yeah, staggering blows to your well-being, increase GDP, increase your GDP per capita. You know, the fact that you're shelling out $50,000 in tuition for at NYU Law School and your counterpart in Europe is getting it for free, how pathetic for the poor European, because the fact is that over in America, we're increasing our GDP per capita this way. But it is dragging down people's standard of living. It's a very perverse system of counting. And you say it's all addition and no subtraction. It's not even all addition. The greatest thing that increases your well-being or your really gross domestic product, the material standard of living is your leisure time.
Yeah.
You know, in a country like India, of course, that's at the bottom of the society with the untouchables. That's absolutely not the case. Leisure is just a nightmare. Unemployment is a nightmare. But to a certain extent, having no leisure is a loss of material value to you. I mean, you can do all sorts. Leisure is like a consumer good. Leisure to go to hear a free concert over at the Millennium Park, which we have here in Chicago, which is all people talk about. You know, if you've been there once, you know what I'm talking about. It's a glorious experience. People in Europe are gaga about it because it's the one thing in America that just seems to them the most European. These wonderful orchestras, pop bands, jazz bands playing right in the middle of the city, gorgeous lawns, people coming over there and picnicking, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's all free, and it seems to lower the GDP per capita. I mean, it's so un-American. I mean, there's no money going out the door. People are getting this for free. But everyone is thrilled by it, and it makes a mark in your life, and it adds pleasure to your life. But you've not been able to turn it into a quiddity or a sum of dollars that adds to GDP per capita. So it doesn't mean anything here, even though, of course, it means everything.
Yeah. Let me finally jump now to, so we've sort of talked about some of the comparisons. Now, what you say, when we're talking about Germany, the three building blocks of German social democracy are the Works Council, the co-determined boards, or the election of boards of directors by the workers as well as by the hedge fund managers, and the regional wage-setting institutions. Lay out those. First, the Works Councils.
Well, the Works Council is what, if you're, you know, the analogy I used, and it's very fictitious, I'm just sort of being jocular in a way. So imagine a Barnes & Noble bookstore. You know, you might have a Works Council at your particular bookstore, and you elect the employees, and they have all sorts of rights. Not to bargain for wages, that's done by the unions, but they have all sorts of rights that relate to working time and who gets laid off and finding out what the store is going to do. Is it going to close or not? They can go in and look at the books. They can look at anything. And the company, the management of that store, has to enter agreements. You have to have some agreement about working time, and you've got to get the approval of the Works Council as to what it's going to be. So while they can't dictate it, they have enormous control over what working hours will be, who's going to work when and how. The co-determined boards work for the big companies, the global companies that are, you know, beating us, 2,000 employees or more, although you can have them in other situations. And those are boards that are like our board of directors, but maybe more like a super board of directors. It doesn't do as much day-to-day managing as even our board of directors do. And it consists one half of people elected by the workers, and could be any worker, any employee, and one half elected by the shareholders. And the chairman of the board is selected by the shareholders, and the chairman has a double vote, so that if there's a tie between the shareholders and the employees about what the company should do, the shareholders win. But that creates a lot of potential for
that's how
the debate goes.
That's right, because
they only 50-50 get the 50-50 with a tie vote in favor of management. That's, you know, management, capitalism wins by one vote, and it's only by one vote.
And only when it gets to a tie. But you also say that the shoe is on the other foot when it comes to choosing the CEO, correct?
Well, you know, if there's a split in the shareholders about who the workers are going to be the kingmaker.
Right. Okay. So that's work councils. And by the way, you're a labor lawyer. My question about this is, we've heard stories over, and I mean, not just stories, this is the reality over the last 10, 15, 20 years of American workers giving back things. You know, it comes time for to renegotiate the contract, and they create two tiers. They lower their pension guarantees. They change their pensions. They do all sorts of things.
Yes.
I have never heard of any of them saying, we will trade that for the right to elect members to the board.
No.
I mean, they've given things. Why, you're talking about.
Well,
German,
the UAW had somebody on the board once.
Yeah, but I'm saying as a major thrust of an exchange here, it seems crazy because it's like you can't say, well, that won't work, because you go, okay, Germany's beating our pants in manufacturing, and it's 50% there. And I think in there's many other countries where that co-determined board is also happening and growing and prevalent, right?
It's spreading in other European countries. And this is very interesting to me because at the beginning of the book, I sort of describe this kind of socialism in one country situation where, you know, the belief was that co-determination was on the way out because in the global economy, the corporate model du jour of our time was the U.S. model, which was very efficient and just management decided everything and there wasn't anybody like the workers involved in it, no stakeholders. And that was going to displace the German model. And it hasn't. It's very interesting. And in fact, the German model has kind of made inroads on the U.S. model in other European countries.
Well, you quote the German labor minister as saying our biggest export now is co-determination.
Yes, Gunther Horetzky.
So, okay, so that's that. Now, the third one, which is sort of where you say the socialism takes place, is in regional wage.
Well, I just mean that the unions have over there still in reduced form, and I have to emphasize it's much reduced, but they still have some version of regional wage bargaining where they are setting area wage standards that everybody has to comply with. That used to be true here to a lesser extent than in Germany, but it was true here, and now it's disappeared.
Now, when you say regional was true here, was that geographically regional, or was that where you would negotiate with the one of the big three automakers and the others would basically get the same deal?
Yeah, well, it was really national. I was thinking actually more of the United Mine Workers contract, mm-hmm. which was a national agreement for every employer, and dealing with multi-employer associations. It wasn't really like the big three. That wasn't multi-employer bargaining. Where multi-employer bargaining existed is where you've got a council of employers dealing with a union. And that was true in the coal industry, which was, of course, you know, the mother of all industries in the U.S. in the 40s and 50s.
Well,
and in the Teamsters, in the trucking industry, and it's still...
And in the entertainment industry.
And in the
When SAG and AFTRA make an agreement, it doesn't matter who the producer is.
And other places, the rubber industry. I mean, the steelworkers had some version of it in practice.
And you say that
really the UAW sort of did. So.
Yeah, and you're saying that it's broken down, but it's still there to some extent. What that creates is a sense of transparency, right? You know.
People know what their wages are. You know, East Germany was a big factor in the breakdown. I mean, it's just it's a different economy, different world. You can't really have the same labor costs and labor standards over there that you have in West Germany because they didn't have the economy wasn't at that degree of development. It's like, I mean, you can't go in and apply a German wage pattern into, say, Sri Lanka. You know, it just doesn't make any sense. Nothing's going to work.
Right.
And that's way too strong a comparison with East Germany, but they were just at way different levels of development.
Right. Okay, now I'm going to say, listeners, I'm Terrence McNally. Thomas Gagin's who I'm talking with. He's a Chicago-based labor lawyer, author of 6 books. We're talking about the one, Were You Born on the Wrong Continent, that makes the point that we've made over and over again that there are, if you compare your quality of life and your prospective quality of life for you, your children, with a German quality of life, what we have, and see if you agree with what I'm saying, Tom, what we have here is because we have become so geared to the very rich that everything scales up that way. And I know that Robert Frank, the economist, talks about this, that people end up moving into neighborhoods they can't afford because that's where the good schools are that the very rich in that city have. And it just ripples through our economy and our lifestyle in lots and lots of ways. And I highly recommend the book, You're Born on the Wrong Continent. I will tell you, as I began to read it, Tom, I said, this should be a bestseller. It's written with personal stories. It's written with, I mean, it mixes data and story in a way that I think is very effective. It's not a hard read, and it's a real eye-opener. I want to move to the 10 things Democrats could do to win. Any last things you want to say about Were You Born on the Wrong Continent?
I would say that we'd be much more competitive globally if Americans had 6 weeks off and had a chance to go live and see what people are doing in other countries. We'd come back much more sophisticated about them, and we'd probably have better ideas about how to sell things to them.
Right. And the one last thing I will say is that you point out that we chose to compete on cheap labor. And what it meant was that we outsourced all sorts of things. We kept the marketing and the executives here. We moved the manufacturing elsewhere. And now we can say that we've been playing that game now for 20, 30 years. And now it's a good time to look at us versus Germany, who played the opposite game.
Sure. Strategically, it was a very stupid decision. So that the upshot is, 30 years later, the Germans are making money off of China, and China is making big time money off of us.
Exactly. Germany makes money off China selling things to China. We should be competing with Germany to sell to China, and we can't anymore because we left those businesses.
Here is one thing I really try to get across in the book, and I would get on a mountaintop and try to shout here. So many Americans think that we've got this trade deficit because we can't compete with China. We've got this trade deficit because we can't compete with Germany in selling things to China.
Yeah, and that's really
something. Until people wake up and realize that and look at the kind of things that the Germans are doing to keep their manufacturing base and to have some sort of human capital control over the financial capital, we're going to be continuing to run a deficit, which is going to leave us in the clutches of foreign creditors,
right,
and compromise our autonomy as a country.
Right. As you say, this is something that the right wing should be up in arms about.
Absolutely.
If they care about all this America, I want my country back.
They are clueless.
Sovereignty.
They are mortgaging this country's future, and they're too stupid to realize it.
Yeah. Okay, let's turn to 10 things the Dems could do to win. This is something you wrote, I think, September, well, very recently. A couple of days ago,
yes.
It came out. What are the 10
actually
things?
I actually wrote it a while ago.
Yeah, but
they held it on the
they held it.
I shouldn't say that.
No,
They sort of believe in the nation that people tend to pay more attention to things
as it gets closer to the election.
It was very flattering that they ran it in September.
Right. Okay, so what are the 10 things that Dems could do to win? We've got 10 minutes.
Can I summarize them generally without
absolutely.
Saying what they are specifically?
Oh, absolutely. I'd
say that the Democrats have to do something for their base and keep it simple and make it universal, not like the health care bill that Obama provided, which was perceived as just a handout for them, quote-unquote, the uninsured, the people who don't vote for us anyway, and live in the red states. Now, what I thought the Democrats should do is to focus on things that either give a direct benefit to people or give them a sense of power that they can use, not the federal government, but that they can use. So, for example, in terms of benefits, I mean, I argue for an increase in Social Security so that it's a real public pension, bringing it up, not immediately, but just setting it as out there as a goal, at least 50% of working.
Now let's so people know, Social Security in the U.S. is what, 37% at this point?
37, 38.
Okay, and in Germany it was 67. It's dropped?
It's dropped to the low 50s.
Okay.
But they have all sorts of, they have, you know, people have tons of money in the bank over there. There's a high savings rate, and they also have private pensions that work for them much better than in the U.S.,
right,
at least in the unions.
Right. So, and they also don't graduate college with thousands and thousands of dollars of debt that they will then carry with them for the rest of their lives
Well, the German system has been ratcheted down, and they do have a demographic crisis over there that they're going to have to get through, but, they've protected the system, basically.
But I'm just saying,
other European countries pay even higher rates.
When you raise, say, Social Security to 50% of working income, that means that when you go on to Social Security, you're now getting half of what you were getting when you were working?
Yeah.
And currently, you get a little bit more than a third.
Most OECD countries, I mean the top 20 developed countries, they have an average rate of something like 60%.
Okay.
So we can do that. The second proposal is really the most effective way to move ultimately to a single-payer system, which I think we have to do. And I say that not because I would say that even if I didn't think single-payer were a better system. I'd say that because you have to have one consistent system of payment of the healthcare system so you get control of healthcare costs. All the European countries do that. It doesn't have to be single payer, but it has to be a consistent system. You can't have private market and single payer.
But you can't control costs with a jumble of things that can play off against each other.
And this is really a good point about this, some of the recent literature. So my proposal is just to lower Medicare to 55. For one thing, that would take over the bulk of healthcare costs. It would take it off employers. What is it that brought back GM and Chrysler? It was the government coming in and taking away the retiree healthcare costs and spinning them off.
That's right.
And that's really made them more competitive. We've got to lower labor costs, not by bringing down wages. That's be a disaster, but by having the government assume these non-wage labor costs that are making us less competitive and inducing more investment into the manufacturing globally competitive parts of the economy.
So let me again, rather than making you go through all 10, what you're saying is do things for the base, make them simple, make them universal, and the first two fit that. So
really are simple. I'm just making them more complicated than
During the healthcare debate, that is exactly what I was advocating was, Medicare, drop it. I was, drop it to 55 and know that you will try in a few years when you've made some savings to drop it to 50, et cetera, et cetera.
People won't be against that. And I'll tell you who's for it. People 55 to 65, they'll all vote for you.
You're right.
It will change their lives.
Now, the two things that you've said, though.
Changed my life.
Social Security, increasing the benefit, increasing Medicare.
And I have ways of paying for it.
Okay. Because I was going to say, of course, the big thing, Alan Simpson, Pete Peterson and all these people are going to say, wait a minute, you're going in exactly the wrong direction.
Well, I think that first of all, Social Security basically is solvent now, even at its current level. But if you got rid of the estate, if you brought back the estate tax, Robert Ball, the Social Security Commissioner, has said this, if you did things like eliminate the corporate debt deduction for debt that is used in leverage buyouts and non-productive uses right now, I mean, you could generate the capital. You could generate the financial reserve that could pay for this. And I do think people should pay a little more for the Social Security because they're going to get a better deal. It is their retirement system.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things have two purposes. One is to do something directly beneficial to the base now and to do something that reduces the size and influence of the financial sector or non-productive parts of the economy and increases the viability of manufacturing. So Medicare, for example, by assuming these labor costs has this Chrysler GM effect. It allows employers to substantially lower their labor costs. And it's not so much that has to be lowered to make them competitive, but as to induce investment into these kind of things, which right now is skewed away from it, partly because of the uncertainty of labor costs, partly because of the uncertainty of healthcare costs.
Exactly.
So you want to reduce that to push investment into that area, because ultimately the goal of all of this is to get the United States out of debt. The debt issue ought to be the Democrats' issue, not the Republicans. And the debt issue, the real debt issue, is the fact that we run this external trade deficit, and we either have to have consumers go into debt to pay the balance at the end of the day and make the books balance, as we did during the Bush era. Everybody went into debt. Or we have to have the federal government do it when consumers cut back, because we don't earn our way in the world. And until we do, we're going to be running either large consumer debts, which lead to private financial panics, or federal debt, which could lead to a sovereign default. I mean, we've got to get out of that box. And the only way to do it is to put in measures that make our economy not more productive, but more competitive globally.
So
do
you're
what
saying,
the Germans do, basically.
You're saying
run
that,
trade surpluses.
That an Obama or, you know, the Democratic Party could take the debt, which everyone, which the right has made a hot issue for them, and transform it into something which actually says, okay, we're not going to deny it's there, it's real, but it isn't, here's some solutions that, and what you're saying is, that say it's not about just paying the bill, it's about restructuring our ability to pay the bill in the future.
Right. We will never get out of debt, whether it's, we can get out of federal debt, but that just means we'll have more consumer debt. We will never get out of debt until we get out of this national debt, our inability to pay our way in the world. As long as we're in that situation, somebody's going to be in debt. Whether it's me, the taxpayer, or me, the consumer, paying off my Visa card, doesn't make a whole lot of difference in the end, at the end of the day. It's a bad scene, and we've got to get out of it. And the Democrats ought to present themselves as the party that has a plan to get the country out of debt.
Wow, I absolutely agree. Let me just mention a couple of the other things, because they fit very well. One is to put a usury cap on. So this is, again, it's about debt. To get even stronger with the credit cards.
And you've got to get the returns down in the financial sectors and the returns up relatively in the manufacturing sector.
Sure.
That's the key. And once you present that program, you also split the business community in this country in a very healthy way, I think, and realize, look, the Democrats are the party of the manufacturers. You want we're going to help you guys, the manufacturers, even if it's at the expense of Wall Street. What's happened now, it's always looked the other way.
Right.
And people perceive that, and they're frustrated by it.
Yes. I mean, my analysis, Tom, is that the financial sector funds both parties, and the Republicans end up being true to their convictions, and the Democrats end up negotiating with themselves because they have some progressive leanings, and then their funders pull them in the other direction.
Yes, but you know, one of the sad things is that even the progressive Democrats don't have the I don't think they have the sophistication of their counterparts in France and Germany on the left.
In terms of understanding what would actually change things.
Well, and in terms of understanding how important it is not to run a debt, not to run a national debt, not to run to be kind of old-fashioned mercantilist country. I mean, the way we perceive it here is, oh well, we've got to go out and march against Mexico, and we've got to put up tariff walls. They don't do that over
right.
in Europe.
Right.
Not that.
Well, you say, and I'll just throw this to you and say you've got 30 seconds. One of the quotes that really struck me is, "Without an industrial base, a democracy dies."
Yeah. My own favorite ending line for this interview from the book would be, countries like Germany do capitalism and socialism better than we do.
Okay, let's let it go at that. So the book is Were You Born on the Wrong Continent? The website is tomgeoghan.com, and I'm going to spell it again, TOMGEOGHAGEN.com. Easily, Google Were You Born on the Wrong Continent, and you'll get how to spell Tom Geoghan's name, and then that'll lead you to the website. The article, 10 Things Democrats Could Do to Win, which I think people probably want to read, where can they find that?
Well, it's in The Nation magazine.
So TheNation.com.
TheNation.com,
and look for that one. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to our podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly, either at my website or at iTunes. The website is TerrenceMcNally.net. One word, TerrenceMcNally.net. Or a world at justmightwork.com. You can also sign up for my weekly email that comes to you and tells you who's going to be on and what we're going to talk about. You can do that either at my website or by emailing me at temcnally@mac.com. Thank you, Tom Geoghan. Keep up the good work.
Sure, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.